Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
He dropped the ball, but when I hit him, I lowered my head too much. I remember I spun around. I crushed two cervical vertebrae in my neck and badly damaged my spinal cord. And so after I hit, I spin around. I'm laying kind of face down on the ground with my head turned to the right. And so, and I can see, you know, through my helmet, I can see my right arm, which was only 12, 13 inches away from my head or from my face. But man, it's weird. It was like it wasn't even my arm. It wasn't even attached to me. And I remember going through the motion of trying to get up, and I watched my arm just roll over. And when I watched it roll over, I couldn't feel it roll over. I couldn't feel anything. And that was the last movement I had for, you know, at least another month.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Rod, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, it's great to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I actually found out about your story by way of somebody who knew you. And when I read, you know, sort of the description of your life story, I thought, yeah, this is definitely something that really resonates with me. But before we get into all that, I want to start by asking what I think is a very relevant question, given where this begins. And that is, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
You mean social group being like the popular kids or?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Okay. Well, I would have to say I was definitely one of the popular kids and probably one of the leaders of the popular kids. And that was even after my injury and after everything and my, you know, my paralysis that resulted, you know, in junior high. So my ninth grade year, which I was in junior high, that was kind of my last year of being physically normal. And I was, you know, the quarterback on the football team, played basketball, baseball, and actually did very well academically, too, even before the injury. Then the injury happens before I'm even a student in high school. And so I come in as a sophomore in high school after the injury. And but, you know, it's amazing how things kind of plug back in to normal. But still part of the popular group. But, you know, one thing, you know, and it's interesting you asked that question. I think one thing that's interesting is, you know, even though, you know, I was certainly in the popular group, you know, and I know I think maybe today in high school it's a lot more cliquey. Back when I was in high school, you didn't have that much clickiness. I mean, I probably had a group of, you know, 50 friends that were, you know, we were all friends. You know, there really wasn't a lot of, you know, pointing to the, hey, look at that group of nerds or something like that. We just didn't really do that. You know, you'd go to the cafeteria to eat lunch and, you know, you'd sit with, you know, different people every day.
Yeah. Yeah. So for people who don't have any context about the injury, take us to that moment, because, you know, like I said, you know, before we hit record here, as I was reading the story, I was like, wait a minute, this is literally the first episode of Friday Night Lights in your life story. You know, when I was as hearing that. So take us to that moment. But I do want to ask you quite a bit about playing football, because that's one of those things that especially quarterbacks are people that I've always been fascinated by.
OK, sure. Well, OK, so I said, I'm coming into high school. I'm 15 years old. Finished, you know, junior high in the ninth grade, that would have been around May. That summer, I'm practicing all summer, you know, just doing drills and just practicing football, getting ready for the fall. The week before school's supposed to start, this high school where I went, which was South Stokes High School in Walnut Cove, North Carolina, To give you some context, I mean, a country high school. The largest city to us was Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We were north of Winston-Salem. We're about maybe 30 minutes north of Winston-Salem. So we started the week before high school. We had those that want to play football. We went to what was called football camp. And so everybody lived at the high school. We, you know, had sleeping bags and we slept in the classrooms for a week and practice, had just intense practices for that entire week. you know, I was a pretty good athlete, and I was one of the fortunate ones. Only two sophomores made the varsity, and I was one of them. So at the end of the week, we had the inter-squad scrimmage where we're dressed out, you know, full uniforms like we were going to play a regular game. You know, the scrimmage is open to the whole town. You know, place is full of people. You know, I've never played on a stage that large in my life. You know, it's all, you know, junior highs. That was the largest, you know, no big stadiums with, you know, the really manicured grass. And, you know, so this was a pretty big deal for me. So I'm a little jacked up when I'm out there. So I was actually the starting free safety. I'd earned the starting free safety job just in football camp and was, you know, was pushing to be the starting quarterback. We just hadn't gotten there yet. So how it happened in the scrimmage, you know, we broke up into, you know, we started with the first string defense going to play an offense. But, you know, back then, as opposed to now, you know, the really good players played both ways. And now you have a separate offense and a separate defense typically. And so the offense was kind of a, you know, makeshift kind of put together type offense just to give us a look and to run some plays against us. Well, the tight end on that offense, who was typically the starting guard on offense, just for fun, he split out and played tight end. And this kid was about 6'3", probably weighed 265, 270, a huge guy. Went on to play college football at Wake Forest. So he goes to tight end. I'm playing free safety, and I'm probably 6 feet, maybe weigh 160. So I'm not. You know, I hadn't at this point in my life, I hadn't been in the gym to, you know, I'm just not old enough. You know, I've been in junior high. You know, these guys, I mean, this tight end was a senior, had been, you know, lifting weights for 3 solid years. Well, anyway, the first play was a pass across the middle. I saw him, you know, come across the line, saw the quarterback, tracked his eyes, saw where he was going with the ball. Couldn't get there fast enough to intercept it. But when the ball got close, when it hit his hands, I hit him as hard as I could. And, I was kind of jacked up. I wanted to show everybody there, you know, new guy here. I want to show everybody how hard I can hit. And I did. And, he dropped the ball, but when I hit him, I lowered my head too much. I mean, not an intentional trying to spear him or anything. But hit him hard, hit him on the crown of my head, my helmet hit the top of his thigh. And when I hit, I remember I spun around, I crushed two cervical vertebrae in my neck and badly damaged my spinal cord. And so after I hit, I spin around, I'm laying kind of face down on the ground with my head turned to the right. And so, and I can see, you know, through my helmet, I can see my right arm, which was only 12, 13 inches away from my head or from my face. But, it's weird. It was like it wasn't even my arm. It wasn't even attached to me. And I remember going through the motion of trying to get up, and I watched my arm just roll over. And when I watched it roll over, I couldn't feel it roll over. I couldn't feel anything. And that was the last movement I had for, you know, at least another month. Yeah. So that's kind of a breaking point in the story, if you want me to stop there.
Yeah. No, so, you know, like I remember, cause it was it was in the very beginning of the book, you said, you know, I was 15 years old in 1981 when I broke my neck playing high school football. And you mentioned that, you know, you were, you know, one of the most heralded athletes in the school's history. And you said, you know, one game I threw for over 400 yards and 5 touchdowns. I averaged 20 points in a game in basketball. I played baseball and ran track. You seem like you're almost this athletic phenom as a freshman who was destined for really, really big sort of athletic success. And to have something like that happen so early, what did that do for your sense of identity? Because, you know, I've talked to people who are professional athletes, and when their career ends, whether it's through an injury or whether it's through just the shelf life of an athlete, this is one of the biggest challenges they have, is finding who they are in, you know, after something that has defined them for so long.
Right. Well, you know, what may be a little bit different from me than like these professional athletes is that I was so young when this happened. I mean, only being 15 years old but really my whole life before then, I mean, athletics was such a large part of it. And I tell you, it was kind of hard in the book just to, you know, list some of my stats because I didn't want to come off as, you know, bragging or anything. But I thought it was necessary to kind of set the table or set the tone as to kind of, you know, this was a kind of a far fall from really being kind of that good. But as far as the how it changed my identity, like I said, all right, so I'm only 15. And so the truth of the matter is I don't think the 15-year-old brain could really comprehend what had happened. And we can talk about going through the next 3.5 months of rehab and then back to school.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, when I plugged back into school, my identity, I don't think it changed at all. And it's because, you know, I was pretty smart. You know, I made really good grades, you know, before this injury. And then I continued to make good grades. My identity changed as an athlete, and there were some tough times about that. I remember, especially like going to basketball games and sitting in the stands, watching my friends play and doing well, knowing that if I were out there, I would be doing just as well and just having a good time. And here I am, you know, no longer an athlete sitting in the bleachers. And that was kind of tough. I'll admit that. And that was tough to get over. But as far as my identity and far as my life went, when I plugged back into school, personality wise, the way I was treated by my friends, my competitive drive, especially my competitive drive, it didn't end with the injury.
Yeah. Well, so I want to come back to this, but I have to ask you about the actual experience of becoming this good, because I played one semester of seventh grade junior high football in Texas. And you know this from playing football in Texas. There are seventh graders the size of grown men. As a scrawny Indian kid, I quickly realized football was not for me. I even remember when the coach called me in eighth grade. He's like, "Are you coming out for football this year?" I was like, "Why would I come out for football to get the shit beat out of me?" Like, it was the kind of thing where, you know, those tackling drills where this was my hero moment. Like, the coach complimented some kid who wanted to be a wide receiver who volunteered to play center. And I was like, and the coach was like, "I need a guard." And I thought, "Oh, this is it. This is my perfect opportunity to be validated by the coach." And so we get up, we do these tackling drills, you know, when you have lineman drills, and literally it was me against this huge kid, and he pushed me back like 20 yards, and everybody just started laughing. And I think that was my moment where I realized, all right, this is not meant to be. But what is it that leads to the level of skill and performance that somebody like you had, particularly at such a young age? Like, what enabled that?
Well, I think you have to have some natural ability or some God-given ability. But I tell you, I think why, you know, I became a good athlete is when I was a kid, I was outside playing constantly. I mean, I was, you know, there wasn't any, you know how it is today with video games and that kind of stuff. There was none of that. And I was outside. I mean, I would, you know, I started playing backyard football when I was 5 years old. And just played and played and played. And I think that, just that the constant, you develop early, you develop your athletic skills, out there, by doing it. And I think that had a lot to do with it. But I mean, there's just different people have different talent levels. I mean, you know, some people are smarter than others. Some people are better looking than others, and some people are better athletes than others. You know, you get what you get. I must have had some natural ability because, I did. I mean, I did well, you know, even starting in Little League football, you know, I did well. And I did well in basketball also. And baseball too. But just it's natural talent plus playing a lot. I remember in junior high, My buddy and I used to, in the summertime, we would play basketball one-on-one, you know, hours. I mean, in the hot sun.
I remember doing that as well.
Yeah. I mean, we just played and played and played. And that's how you get better, is by playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I remember in seventh grade, I was the most improved player on my basketball team. And I was always joke. I was like, that just means you're the shittiest player on the team. But I remember the summer between seventh and eighth grade, my math teacher coached the girls basketball team. And he had watched when we practiced. He said, wow, you've gotten a lot better. One other question about this. So I remember that seventh grade summer when I played, and you know this from, you know, being out in the heat in the North Carolina, in the Texas humidity and heat, you get out there and you're thinking, oh, this is going to be so much fun and amazing. And the moment you put on those pads and you put on those helmets, you realize I'm going to get sick or I'm going to throw up. And I had two friends who were huge kids and they quit after 2 days and I stuck it out the entire season. Why do you think that is? Like, what is it that differentiates people? Like, because they definitely were far more probably prone to actually succeed than I was.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Well, what it is that makes some people stick it out and some not. I'm going to guess, like for your situation and for mine too, you probably had parents that instilled the thought process in your head that once you start something, you're going to finish it. Yeah. And, you're not going to be a quitter. I couldn't imagine, and not just sports, but just quitting anything in the middle of it. If I've committed to doing something, man, I couldn't imagine. And it's just how I was brought up. It's how I was raised.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Well, I mean, now that I know the timeline of the 80s and, you know, you mentioned you're in Mobile, Alabama, and, you know, just given our current context, I have to ask, like, what were race relations like at the time when you grew up, and how did sports play a role in that?
Well, man, that's That's a great question. And let me go back to, I put this in the book, and I put it in there for the, you know, for a specific reason, to talk about race relations a little bit. And of course, it's part of my growing up. But before I moved to King, North Carolina, when we went to the seventh grade, and that's where I was throughout the rest of my, you know, junior high and high school, I lived in a town called Emporia, Virginia. Now, Emporia is probably about 50%, at least 50% black, 50% white. That was the first time I'd ever gone to, you know, public elementary school when there were, you know, just as many black kids as white kids. Although, as far as I'm concerned, in that town, the race relations I had with my friends who were black kids was really good. However, in that town, it was still segregated as far as like the youth sports teams. Not that there were any rules that, hey, no blacks can come over and play in the white league. And I think maybe one or two would, but it was just kind of the culture of the town. But it's interesting that when we moved to that town, I think we were there only 2 years. The first year, my brother's a year older than I am, we played in the, you know, football in the white league. Well, the next year, my dad decided that my dad always wanted to coach us, and he wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't allow him to coach in the white team. So he went over to, it was called the Community Youth Center, CYC. That's where all the black kids went. And he coached that team. And my brother and I, there was about 60 kids on the team. So there's two white kids and about 58 black kids. And we had played that football season together. I was in the, sixth grade, and my brother was in the seventh. And it was one of the greatest experiences of my life, even today, looking back on it, because we were actually friends with these kids. This wasn't, you know, just the two token white kids. That's kind of in reverse of what you normally hear. But yeah. And it was one of the greatest experiences that I've ever had. Now, moving to King, North Carolina, completely different in high school, because there just weren't nearly the amount or the number of black kids there. But there were no problem. I don't think there weren't. I mean, there wasn't any problems, any race relation problems there. But now, when I moved to Alabama, and because this was after, you know, I graduated from law school in '92, not that there were any big race problems down here when I got here, but it's a different. Kind of attitude, I think, about race relations in what I will call the Deep South, which is like Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, as opposed to Tennessee and North Carolina and Virginia.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the reason that question came up for me when I was hearing you write about football and sort of the South is, you know, like I said, I grew up in a small Texas town, and there were definitely undertones of racism. Like I remember very distinctly, I had a friend, you know, we had a black kid who got stabbed at our school, like they got in a fight. And, you know, I had this very close friend, and his parents were very, very kind to me. And there were days when I would hear things come out of their mouth, and it was just like blatant racism towards black people, yet they didn't have the same attitudes towards me. And I think what always struck me about that was we weren't talking about uneducated rednecks. We're like talking with people with PhDs who come from the wealthiest families in town. And I just found that so striking that somebody who is so educated, somebody who is that wealthy, could have that attitude. It really, you know, it was shocking every single time I heard it, because here I am, this kid in seventh grade, hearing his mom, my friend's mom, like make these racial slurs while driving me to school. And it just really struck me as so strange.
Yeah. And I've grown up with that too. I mean, that's, I don't think that's uncommon, but I tell you what I do think is happening now, or I think it's every generation. Like, I don't think our generation does not have is not as racist as the last. And I think the as you get away from, say slavery, and, you know, I guess with 1860s and, you know, the farther you get away from it, I think the better it has become. I mean, my kids aren't, I mean, there's no racist thought that I think ever enters their heads. You know, but I did grow up, you know, and I think, and as you said too, even other kids' parents would make, you know, just kind of the snide comments sometimes. And you just, I wasn't raised like that. So, I mean, and it's not like I wouldn't say anything. I just kind of, you know, listen to it and kind of, okay.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's interesting, you know, being an Indian person, like, you know, we're like, you know, and I'm not saying this out of ego, but like people kind of view us as sort of a model minority, right? Like, what do Indians do? We start companies, we become doctors and engineers and lawyers. And so yet, but I mean, I've even heard racist things come out of my own parents' mouth where I'm like, okay, that's a little weird. Why did you say that? But, you know, I want to come back to the race thing when we talk about your career as a lawyer, because I think there's a lot of interesting ties there. But let's go back to this moment, you know, in rehab. You know, the thing that really struck me at the beginning is, you know, you said maybe because of my youth or brain condition, I was always upbeat in the days following surgery. I smiled and laughed at my family and friends who came to visit. My smile was actually genuine. Oddly, I was never depressed. My life had been forever changed. But for some reason, I was always genuinely upbeat. And that stood in such stark contrast to that, you know, moment in Friday Night Lights when you get to the second episode and Jason Street is like, you know, on the verge of breaking up with his girlfriend and all hell breaks loose. And like, what is it? Like, why is it that you had this response to such a tragic situation and other people don't?
You know, I'm not sure. Although I'm not sure everybody, you know, would have a different attitude on with they had their tragic situation. But you know, I think it goes back to, you know, when I had the accident, I had my life prior to that was about as spectacular as it could be. And, you know, so your personality is based on that. And so you have this level of confidence, you know, that is ingrained in you. And so when this happened, you know, your personality just does not change overnight. So you're still the same person inside that, you know, this whole 15 years of your life, this person that and personality that's been created. You have this horrible, tragic event. Now you're lying in a hospital bed and you cannot move anything, you know, below the neck. But what you've brought into it stays with you. And so, you know, and I don't know why it was that, you know, I did some, I mean, I genuinely stayed upbeat. Now that doesn't mean I didn't have a day or two where, you know, I had some bad days, but for the most part, yeah, I mean, I was genuinely an upbeat person. You know, I guess it was the, you know, especially once I started being able to move, you know, some stuff again, it was, all right, let's, you know, let's get into rehab and let's see what we can do and see what we're going to have left to move on with my life.
Yeah. Well, I think that what's interesting to me is you did far more than move on with your life. I mean, you went on to become class president. You had girlfriends. You were a valedictorian. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary considering that, you know, you faced adversity that would probably, you know, derail the average person. So I guess where I want to start is, you know, how did this end up affecting your friendships and your relationships? Because again, like, you know, your story, like other than the moment of the injury, when I compare it to the you know, Friday Night Lights TV show where this guy's girlfriend dumps him, his friendships change, yours is like the polar opposite. You know, your girlfriend stayed with you. You became class president. So I had to ask, you know, how did this end up in fact affecting your social relationships and your, you know, relationship with your family?
Well, social relationships were not affected at all. You know, I stayed friends with the friends I had. I, you know, had more friends even after it. You know, even today, I'm very close with my best friend from high school. We played basketball together. He didn't play football, but he played basketball. We're still great friends today. You know, not my girlfriend. You know, here I was coming in. I was going to be big man on campus. I decided I needed to break up with her before high school started, which I did. And then this happened. But she graciously took me back. But you talk about a hit there. It makes you a little bit more humble. You know, when you have something like this. But and I dated her throughout high school, and then you know went off to college, and it was kind of how that goes. My friends never, like I said earlier, they did not ever treat me any differently. And my family was basically the same too. I mean, my brother's a year older than me. We've always been close. I've got three sisters. My parents are divorced now, but they were married throughout, all of my schooling, and they didn't get divorced till later on in life, but still very close to them. One thing when you have an injury like this, it's taxing on your family. My mom was at the hospital and the rehab center every day, and we've got at the time I had, my brother was at home and I had two sisters at home. They've got lives going on. My dad's out running his business. My grandmother came over to live with us for a while to do the cleaning and the cooking, and it's taxing. So it's not just you that's me that's affected by this. It affects everybody. And I think when I first got back to high school, I think my friends may have been a little, a little tepid, maybe, or not nervous, but I mean, treat me a little, not nicer or anything, but just, like I was a little more fragile, of a person than I was, but it didn't take long because I didn't really change as a person inside. And then things just, started going on as they normally did.
So you went on to become a trial lawyer. What prompted your interest in the law, of all things?
My grandfather was a lawyer and a judge. And so that was kind of it. But I didn't have some burning desire to be a lawyer. I was more interested in business. I was an economics major undergrad. And, I basically went on to law school because, I knew I wanted to go to graduate school, and I didn't really know, really what I wanted to do. So I just signed up for law school, and then off I went. And then, I did the, once I got there, I did the JD MBA program, to get my master's in business, just cause I was really probably more interested in that, but in my career, I've just been a straight up lawyer without having the business part of what I studied has had nothing to do with being a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of why I wanted to talk about law in particular is because I think it's such an interesting career, particularly in the context of race, the fact that you're a lawyer in the South. Like when I think about the fact that you're in Mobile, I'm guessing you're probably very familiar with Brian Stevens' work on the his Equal Justice Initiative project. And, when you read a story like Just Mercy and you see what happens, I've had, criminal defense attorneys here. So I think we love the idea of, justice being black and white, but it's not. And you're a lawyer. Why is that? Why is it? It seems to me like this system does not really, it's not equal justice.
Well, first of all, I do not do any criminal work.
Yeah.
But now I'll tell you, one of my best friends, I hit the gym every morning, before work. And one of my best friends, does the same, and he is a criminal defense lawyer. He'll tell me, he'll say, look, when we live on the other side of Mobile Bay, we got about a 10-mile, or 8 to 10-mile trip across Mobile Bay to downtown Mobile is where we work. And one of the ways you can get across either the interstate or what's known as the causeway, which is the highway that goes across, it's part land and part water, part bridge. But he said, he tells me, he goes, look, when I see policemen you know, have people pulled over on the causeway. He goes, 9 times out of 10, they're black.
Yeah.
Not the policeman, but who's getting pulled over. And, you know, I've never noticed that because, you know, him being a criminal defense lawyer, he sees this more than I do. And so it's more, you know, it's more apparent and it's more part of his life. That's what he sees. And, you know, why that is, I guess that's why we're going through what we're going through today with, with the Black Lives Matter. It's real. There's no doubt about it. But further to the question was, why justice isn't the same or fair or I don't know. I mean, just getting on beyond a black and white or a racial thing is, I remember when I first started practicing, I thought judges, here I am, I guess when I'm 24, 25 years old, I guess 26 when I first started practicing law. And so you go in, you're just some, you're new and you get into the courtroom for the first time. And these judges, they're all so much older. Most of them were male with white hair and gray hair. And you thought that oh my God, these must be the wisest people that there is. And they'll follow the law and they're going to make these incredible wise decisions. Well, but the thing is, what I've learned is, judges, when they make decisions on cases or in legal matters, they bring their personality and their political views into that office. You got plaintiffs oriented judges, you got defense oriented judges, you got judges that are down the middle. I mean, there's some judges down here that, how they're going to rule on something. But before you even, file a motion, if you're going to win it or not, because I'm a defense lawyer. And some judges are very plaintiffs oriented and they're not like, say you file a motion for summary judgment, which is something that, gets the case thrown out as a matter of law, even though you think it's due to be granted, going in, it's not going to be. And that's just, you don't have these aren't computers up there that get all the information and process it and come out with what should be the correct decision. These are people up there making decisions, and their past and their experiences go into and their biases go into their decisions.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about next is biases. So, I had Sean Askenazi here, who was a former criminal defense attorney, turned chocolate maker. And one of the things that he said that really struck me, we were talking about plea bargains, and he said, people take plea bargains all day long for crimes they didn't commit because they're so terrified of the alternative, which is basically a much lengthier sentence. He said, if half these people actually went to trial the way they, are supposed to be able to, the entire system would break down. So, what I wonder is when you have biases embedded into people, and, of course, all of us have biases, is there any way to achieve some level of objectivity in the system?
Well, because of the way the jury system works. I mean, you're going to have, and what I'm saying, I mean, you're going to have 12 in Alabama, you're going to have 12 people on a jury in a criminal or any case that's in the state court system. And so the way you get objectivity is if you get jurors that, really you want the biases to equal out. You got people on the left, you got people on the right. So what you want is a decision that comes out, that takes away biases because they got to work it out. And then you get that final decision or, the verdict. And that's the way you want it. That's why in what I do, jury selection is so important. Making sure it's not that you get the right jurors. You just want to make sure you don't get the wrong jurors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it kind of makes me wonder, you being a lawyer in a place like Mobile, Alabama, you kind of alluded to it. When you see what's happening right now in this country as a lawyer, you know, particularly a lawyer in the South, you know, what do you make of it? You know, do you, in your mind, where, what is our path to change here? A change that actually leads us to a better place.
Well, see, and that's the problem with all this. You know, I see the demonstrations, you know, some peaceful, I see the riots, and it seems like it's all really, I mean, what the stimulus for all that was, or what was the, you know, it started with, you know, the one up in Minnesota where the cop is kneeling on the guy's neck and then he dies, which, you know, and everybody sees that video and you're just like, oh my God, this is, I mean, if you watch that and think that's okay, I mean, I think there's something wrong with you. But that's, I mean, and then all the past, it's the white cops killing the black guys. And that's kind of that's the way this has kind of all started. And there must be some sort of a problem there, but being down here in Mobile, Alabama, I don't stay in some ivory tower where I go to work. I mean, I'm out in the community somewhat. I don't see this systemic racism at the ground level. Wow. I mean, I've got a black kid who's my little brother. We started off in Big Brothers, Big Sisters. When he was probably in the third grade, I'd go see him at his elementary school once a week. And now he is a sophomore in high school. And what we do now is, you know, about once a month or maybe a little more frequently, you know, I come, I pick him up, and we go out. We either, you know, we have lunch, we go to the movies, we hang out, we just talk. And so, you know, I see nothing, you know, between the two of us, of course. I mean, it's just it's a wonderful relationship. But I mean, I see his friends and stuff. And, you know, I don't see this racism, at least not in any form that is, you know, palpable or just you know, right out in the open. And it may be because Alabama was, like in Mississippi, were so bad for so long that I think racism down here is probably not as bad as it is in other states.
Yeah. That makes me kind of wonder, you know, I think what I wonder is what misperceptions, because, you know, I mean, I'm a liberal person who grew up in California, of all places, where it's incredibly diverse. And, you know, I mean, it's very clear, like, you know, very few people in where I live, you know, tend to vote Trump. And, you know, I wonder what misperceptions do you think that somebody like me or people like, you know, myself and, you know, my peers who basically consume media that would be considered, you know, left biased media have about places like Mobile? Because I think that in our minds, I think our stereotype of Alabama, which isn't entirely accurate. And I, you know, this is something I even learned in Texas. My mom commented, you know, when we moved to California, she said, you know, she's like, I think I miss about being in College Station is people are so friendly there. Like, you go to a bar in Texas or you go into a restaurant, people are just friendly. They talk to you. Whereas, you know, you go to a grocery store in California, people are like, get on. There's other people here.
Yeah. Well, that's how it is. I mean, in Mobile, it's a friendly place. You know, you go to the grocery store, you go to bars, you go to restaurants. It's, yeah, people talk with each other. It's, I mean, it's kind of a nice place to be. But, you know, I think, though, the perception of Alabama going so far back and the way it's been portrayed in movies, although, you know, like Mississippi Burning, of course, that was over in Mississippi, but then you got, you know, like the up in Selma, the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. I mean, that stuff happened. I mean, I think it takes a long time to even attempt to erase those memories, which, I mean, I don't think you ever want to completely erase that memory anyway, because you need your history out there. But I mean, there was some bad stuff going on in the Deep South, and you know, I think there's a museum in Montgomery, I think, that has all the it's got, you know, stories or at least the names of all the black people that were lynched and killed in Alabama. And it's just, I've not been there. I want to go, but, I mean, it's gotta be haunting just to go into a place like that. And that really happened. And, you know, you think today, you know, me, and I mean, I've always grown up in the South, although Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, those are really, I mean, they are the South, but it's really kind of more somewhat mid-Atlantic states, or at least I don't consider that the deep South. But down here, there was some bad stuff that went on. And you can't even, but like sitting here today, you probably can't even, it's hard to even imagine that people could be killed like they were, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, you know, in the United States like that. So I think, though, the perception that you get, you know, if you're not from, you know, this, say you're not from Alabama, that you get this perception that Alabama is such a racist place. It's probably just from the past, but if, you know, if you spend any time here, you know, I don't think there's a huge racial problem down here. I mean, like even in Mobile, there's not been like huge protests, haven't been any rioting down here. And, you know, the city of Mobile is probably 40% black.
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, the other thing I wonder is, having had the life experience you had, you know, having had such a tragic injury, how did that shape and influence the kind of parent you've been and the messages that you've passed on to your kids?
Oh, wow. I'm not sure it has shaped me as far as a parent that much, because I still, even after the injury, I went on to lead the life I wanted to lead, regardless of the injury. And so, you know, the way I lead my life, and I have always since I had my injury, is, I mean, this is just something I've got to deal with, but I'm not going to allow it to affect, you know, the decisions I make and how I go forward in my life. I mean, although I'm not going to, other than, well, I'm not going to take a job as somebody who's going to be, you know, building houses or doing anything.
Yeah.
That's not in the realm of possibility. But, and it's really, you know, even looking back on it, and when you ask me that question, I guess it's really kind of almost surprising how that my injury didn't affect my personality so much. And that I continued to, you know, I was continuing to be competitive. I continued to strive to do the best I could. Like when my son, one of my sons played football, you know, as a kid for a while, and I didn't prohibit it, but I tell you, I did not encourage it. I wasn't going to be one of those parents who like, hey, you know, by God, you're going to get out there and play football because you're going to be a man. There's no way I would have done that, because if something would have happened bad, yeah, I wouldn't be the one, you know, to have pushed a son into that, you know, God, that would have been the worst thing. But, you know, and my kids have, you know, from day one, they've known nothing else other than having a father with a major physical disability. And so, you know, it's, and I don't think they've ever been, I've got a great relationship with my kids. I don't think they've ever been like embarrassed to, you know, be walking around with me, or even, you know, when they're younger, you know, because, you know, all, you know, kids, I've gotten used to, you know, my oldest son, who was, when he was in kindergarten, I would walk him to class every day because he was, you know, he was scared to go in. So, well, I walked for like 30 days. So, you know, I'm walking, you got all these little kids over there, just, you know, as I'm walking, you can just see them staring and, you know, pointing and that kind of stuff. But my kids have never, you know, I don't think they've ever been like, you know, embarrassed, like, oh, there's my dad who walks so funny. I'm trying to think if I've become a different parent because of my injury. I don't think so. I think I've taken the same, same personality, you know, what I brought into the injury, and then what I've learned after it, you know, into being a parent and just trying to be a loving, supportive parent who, you know, I've wanted my kids to be, you know, as successful as possible. But, you know, my wife and I really didn't push our kids. I didn't really push my kids, you know, to the brink of them, like, you know, just, you know, I just can't take this anymore. Or like push them, like, you know, you got to get your grades up. You got to make all A's. You got to be the best athlete. You got to be this. Yeah. That's, you know, we've never done that. We've kind of let our kids kind of become their own people. Of course, the problem with that is, you know, they made okay grades, but they certainly weren't at the top of their class. My two that went to college, they've graduated. They're out working now, and so they seem to be very well adapted kids. And my wife and I did a pretty good job parenting them.
Yeah. So this theme that has, you know, showed up over and over in our conversation of the fact that you weren't going to let this thing define you, and you're going to live your life and you know, push it to the limits of what's possible regardless. And this is something I've asked people in some form or another, the sort of relativity of grief, you know, so people have far worse responses to far less dire situations than the one that you're in. Why is that?
You know, I don't know what's going on in the heads of some other people on why they do this. I mean, it's it may be, you know, what happened in their life before what the event they had, whether it be minor or a major event. I mean, if your personality or your level of confidence, or if you're not a happy person going into something, and then something bad happens, and it may not even be, you know, not that I've ever wanted to compare tragic events, but if somebody, you know, has something that you would think maybe not be that big of a deal, and they just fall apart, you know, it might be that because, you know, the type of person they were coming into it. Like, you know, I was a very strong, confident person when this happened. And so I continued with that. You know, I guess if I, you know, had issues of self-doubt or, you know, problems like that when this happened, maybe the effort or the, you know, to move on and try to live your best life, maybe it wouldn't have been there. It's hard to say really to me why people don't, or why people, some people just kind of quit and fall apart. Why they do, you know, it's, I really don't know.
Wow. Well, this has been really, really fascinating. I've really enjoyed chatting with you and learned a ton. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Give me the definition of unmistakable.
So my definition of unmistakable, because I wrote a book called Unmistakable, and you have to define it apparently when you write a book called that, is something that is so distinctive that nobody else could have done it but you.
Well, it's hard to say that nobody could have achieved what I did after my injury, because I'm sure there's people out there that have had horrible injuries or horrible physical things happen to them that have done just as well or better than I have. But I think what's different, about me is, well, I mean, it was the constant drive to be successful and to live a great life. It was, I mean, knowing, all right, I've got this physical disability. So knowing I'm going to struggle physically every day. I'm going to struggle to walk, you know, to class in college. I'm going to struggle to walk into the office every day. I'm going to struggle to walk in the courtroom. But you don't let the physical struggle, you know, change what you want the outcome to be, which is, you know, I want to live a great life. You know, we got one life. I mean, this is it. And so. So you have one part of your life that you know, is not the greatest, the physical part of it. I'm not going to let that screw up the rest of it. And so I mean, it, to me, it's all this quest for just having a great life because this is all you got, you know. And if you, you know, if you quit, you know, well, then there goes your life. So I guess, you know, to sum it up, I'm all about just having the best, you know, I want to lead the best life I can lead. I want to be as happy as I can. I want to do as many great things as I can. I just want to have a great life.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your book, your work, and everything else you're up to?
Yeah, my book is the best way to do it is just go on Amazon and get it. It's called Get Back Up. Although I do have a website, which my website, though, is not much more than a landing page. It's www.rodkate.com. But, you know, if people want to follow me, I've got a YouTube channel. If they just want to, you know, put Rod Kate in there, I've got some, you know, I've given some talks. I've got some videos of me working out on there. So if you're curious to see how I walk and how I do my physical stuff, I put some of the workout stuff on YouTube. And, you know, I've got an Instagram account. Just, you know, look up Rod Kate. I've got some photos on there, that kind of stuff.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.